Well, hi, everyone. I don't know if you can hear me. Hopefully you can. Hi. Very good.
Yeah. All
right, very good. Rowdy time. While we're doing trivia, does anyone want to guess what percentage of AI researchers at Google are women? No, zero is a good guess, actually, but no. No. 10%. 10%. Anyone want to guess what percentage of Google employees are black? No, lower than 5. 2.5. 2.5%. Welcome to Bias and Facial Recognition. I'm Jairus Khan. I'm ostensibly your moderator. I work for the Mozilla Foundation, which is the nonprofit end of Mozilla. They make Firefox. We make Firefox. The Mozilla Foundation tries to make the internet better. We don't make Firefox. I'll let our co-panelists introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Haley Tsukayama. I'm legislative activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Good morning. I am Erica Portnoy. I am a staff technologist at Electronic Frontier Foundation. I work on CertBot, which is EFF's Let's Encrypt client, helping people to get certificates for their websites so they could turn on HTTPS. And I do a lot of our crypto policy work.
So we're going to talk about a couple things. We're going to talk about facial recognition, kind of AI bias more generally, what the problems are, why it matters, what the impacts are, what we can do about it. I'd like to just start by saying that part of the problem we have is that we are increasingly leaning into these systems and handing over control of a lot of our systems to AI because we have a lot of data to sort through. We have a lot of data to sort through when it comes to our Facebook feed, when it comes to people being released on parole, when it comes to anything and everything, when it comes to Ring deciding who is at your door. So the problems that we're seeing today are really just the tip of the iceberg on what could go wrong and what could happen. I'd like to ask either of you, what do you think right now is the most worrying thing that we're seeing? Like, what's actually happening to people because of bias and facial recognition? What ways is it being applied?
Sure. As sort of in my role as legislative activist, I've been involved quite a bit in the proposals to ban FR in some cities and to place a moratorium on the government use of. We tend to call it face surveillance, which tells you how we feel about it in states and cities. And I think, I mean, to me, it's just the sort of the basic tenet of, you know, I could deny to give my fingerprint. I could, there are things that I could not, you know, that I could say, okay, I'm not happy to hand this over to you, but just walking around and to be surveilled on the one hand is disturbing enough to know that someone could run facial recognition and then literally just track me block by block. So to me, it's just the basic principle of the thing. And the fact, as you said, that they're deploying them in cities with, you know, no real sort of thought about what that means for the people of their cities. That's really what disturbs me, is how quickly it's moving and how little thought we've given it.
I like to think about this in terms of power. And facial recognition technology is a power multiplier for those who have it and use it against their populations. So let's say that the government was interested in tracking some certain people. If they wanted to do this without facial recognition, it would take time and resources. What facial recognition does is it's a multiplier that reduces the amount of time and power that it takes to do that same tracking and surveillance on a much wider scale. And it allows the expansion of police states in a way that has never before been seen, really. A great example of this is what's happening in the Xinjiang region of, right, I see a lot of nods, of China, where the ethnic minority there is being tracked largely through the use of facial recognition technology. And when they go to the mosque, they're always being tracked. When they go home, when they go to work, all of their movements are known to the government and becomes that much easier to exact power.
So when we talk about things like facial recognition, which rely heavily on kind of like AI machine learning, how does that work when it comes to training and training data and figuring out how to get a machine good at a thing? Like what is the system to train an AI to get good at recognizing faces?
I'm gonna throw that to you.
Okay, well, that's a... It's an interesting question that you say there, because good at recognizing faces means so many things, right? So the basic answer is you want to throw a lot of data at the problem. You want a lot and lot of pictures of data. And there's many problems with that already. Let's cue that up so I could just talk about the second thing. What you're going to want to worry about is false positives and false negatives. So this is, do you want a system that, like, when it fails to identify the person as being the correct person, or that when it fails, it recognizes someone else as being the correct person? So if you show it a picture and say, is this person X? And it goes, I don't know, I'm not sure. I don't think it is, and it's right or it's wrong. That's one type of failure. The other type is, I do think it's person X. I'm really excited about this, and I'm misidentifying it as actually being a picture of person B, even though it's actually a person X. But let's get back to the data, because that's much more interesting, because you want to think about the provenance of this data. Where do these faces come from? Who are they training it on? The answer, distressingly enough, is everyone for a lot of the time. Videos like this camera right here is one of the sources of recognition that they scrape through YouTube and get pictures of people who are on panels and things like that, because you want pictures of people mostly looking forward, and that's on video. And panels, it turns out, are a great way to do that. So one of our coworkers, Jillian, actually found out that she was in one of these data sets, the streets of New York. Oh, I forgot the percentage, but it was some distressingly high percentage of people who had just been in the city of New York over in a certain period and walking around the streets ended up in a facial recognition database. So the data that is being used to train these facial recognitions is being taken from people without their consent in public in places that no one would ever expect that data to be taken from.
Right, and so you end up with this situation where you both have a lack of consent from the people involved, and you end up with data sources being used that are either from kind of like, you know, public sources or institutional sources, right, where you'll get like mugshots, right, which are going to disproportionately represent some people over other people, which is going to compound the problem overall, right? So where are we seeing these systems deployed? Or I guess I should ask, who's using them today? Right, like, where is facial recognition actually being deployed? Who's using it? Who's working on it? Who's trying to develop it?
I mean, I think we're seeing a lot of law enforcement use of face surveillance, which, you know, I understand the logic of, I guess, but is disturbing in a lot of ways. And again, back to sort of the training question, right? I can't remember what state it was, but there was a state in which, they had the picture of a suspect and they said, oh, we have this face recognition database. They ran it through. It didn't come up. They said, well, he kind of looks like, I think it is the actor Woody Harrelson. So they ran a picture of Woody Harrelson through the database and then
that
found
seems
a
like
guy.
Cheating.
Yeah, yeah, right? and so, you know, it's very powerful technology. It's in the hands of people who are not, you know, I think if you stopped and thought about basic training, that is a kind of thing you wouldn't do, because due process. And, you know, so, I mean, I think, yeah, we're seeing a lot of law enforcement agencies use it. We're also seeing a lot of airport authorities use it. Of course, the Department of Homeland Security uses it.
Delta uses it now, right? I saw a check-in. I didn't fly Delta, but I saw Delta. You can check in with your face now,
yeah,
right?
They started a trial a couple of years ago, and I think it is... I used to be a reporter, so like my I used to have really good knowledge of recent events, and that's gone down since I moved out of reporting. But I know they had a trial at DCA a couple of years ago. So yeah.
So we're kind of trading, like, on some level, those of us who are kind of opting in, we're kind of trading it for convenience, right? It's like either I could wait in line and hand someone my passport, or.
I mean, you're not always trading it for convenience, right? Like, you don't always have a choice. Some airports, they have it set up, and what you do is you go to the kiosk, and before you go talk to the person, you have to get your face taken. Like, you're treating it, it's not even, you're trading it for convenience, saying, oh, you know, I want a little bit of convenience for my life. No, it's your being required to do it on penalty of, like, extreme inconvenience. Like, oh, no, if you want to do this, you need to go up out of the, like, line of people, go talk to a person and say, I don't even know if you can opt out of it. I hope you can opt out of it. But, like, it's not the same thing as saying, like, oh, I want a little convenience. It's, oh, no, I feel like missing my next connection,
right,
level of inconvenience.
Right. Or, you know, possibly being detained or you know being searched for. You can opt out of it, but it is it can be a process.
Just like where I'm seeing it, I'm in medical. This is moving into jobs. So in my hospital, they're requiring people. They're requiring people to use facial recognition to access the EMR.
And if you choose not to use your facial recognition to access it, then it's much harder to do your job. So your life becomes miserable because I have to do 7 clicks just to look at something because I don't want to use it. And now if you're, you know, a person of color or someone where facial recognition is a whole other thing, you know, so it's creeping into the workplace and it's making it harder and harder to say no.
Sorry, and you said that was for access to medical records?
It's access to, for people working in the hospital.
Right,
making
okay.
Making it faster to do our jobs.
Right, so instead of passwords and key cards, I'm assuming, right?
Like I can use my password and it's 7 clicks for me to get to where I need to do an order or hold an OR or do something for a patient. Whereas if I do my facial recognition, it's so easy.
Right. And this is kind of, you know, when body scanning kind of first came into airports, it was like, well, you can opt out, but we're going to, you know, take 10 minutes to pat you down. And people who, for whatever reason, you know, can't or won't do body scanning, now their life is a lot harder anytime they fly, right? Anyone whose body might confuse the person looking at the other end of it, now their life is a lot harder every time they fly. And as we see facial recognition kind of being increasingly used for identification, it's kind of a growing problem, right?
And I would also say, you know, it's of corporate interest, right? I mean, it's a business that people see a lot of money in. And so, you know, if you look at something like video doorbells, for example, right. Home security cameras, right. You know, I think there's a lot of fear that there's going to be indiscriminate use of FR on those devices. And then, of course, those companies then see a lucrative opportunity for partnership with government. And so everything comes together in one.
Right.
Yeah.
So a question, if we solved the bias problem tomorrow, if we could snap our fingers and suddenly it worked 100% accurate on everyone, would that be good?
Okay, I'm going to unpack that question a little bit, because what does it mean to solve the bias problem? I think this is one of the hard open questions in facial recognition technology. There's an entire conference series devoted to the question of fairness, accountability, and transparency. It used to be called in machine learning, but now it's just in AI, machine learning, et cetera. And for years, the technologists at this conference have been trying to find a way to define bias in a data set, in the output, and it turns out to be a very hard problem that people in the humanities have been dealing with for literally decades. How do you define fairness? What is this definition? What is fairness? Like, we haven't figured this out as a society. You think we're going to figure this out in, like, facial recognition? No, we're nowhere near there. And, you know, it's not like there isn't any work that's been done in the field or any definitions that have been come up with. So, for example, one will define it as, when you look at a data set, the data set is representational, and it will have an exact representation of the human population. Or when you look at an algorithm, it will react in an equitable and just way for whatever population is defined in mathematical terms. So this is ludicrous on several aspects for something that we can hope for to solve all our problems, because several reasons. One is, someone is sitting there and defining with mathematics what is equitable and just. Okay, that's a bit of a stretch, number one. But number two is, when you look at all these different definitions, one of my favorite studies that came out of this conference series is that they contradict each other, and it is impossible to satisfy all of them. So it's like this question of removing bias in the first place, like, that's, it's such a human question. Like, when we have solved bias in humanity, then maybe only after that will we even be able to say that we've solved it. But, you know, but you were probably asking, like, for the sake of argument, let's assume that there's no bias. Are there still problems? And I'll let you answer that one.
Yes. I mean, yeah, I certainly think so. And, you know, you were talking also about sort of places that this is being used. And in California, I'm currently working on a bill to stop the use of real-time facial recognition on police-worn body cameras, which is, you know, that is... Right, that's constant indiscriminate scanning, which is wrong, would chill speech, would invade privacy, and, you know, is just, you know, not the kind of thing that I think, you know, those... That example particularly irks me because I think so many people supported the use of body-worn cameras as a tool of accountability, as a tool of transparency, and to see it being used this way, I find very disturbing.
So. Also, in some way, kind of totally predictable too, right?
Yes.
Like if we figured out a tool that we think is going to kind of bring accountability to the system, at some point probably that's going to get turned against us, right?
There we go.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, there we go. So I just was thinking about in terms of like sort of public scanning, like I'm sure you've heard of like this artist did this like razzle dazzle kind of like paint, like based on the like 1910 like razzle dazzle look for warships to be like, can't see on the coast. Do you think like at some point, like I know like masks aren't allowed, but do you think there might be a point where they might be like, oh, you actually can't wear razzle dazzle makeup because that's like the equivalent of wearing a mask? And you don't want to interfere with like the face recognition.
I think probably what's more likely is that the technology will get good enough that that kind of makeup and kind of, you know, anti-surveillance technology won't work, and so they won't need to. But that's
I don't know.
It's also an interesting question, right? Because so you're dealing with probability and certainty in different facial recognition systems. So I can imagine there being a ban on that at the airport, right? Where like you are stepping up to a camera that you are intentionally taking a picture of your face. But you know, that's a system where the goal is to have a very high probability and a clear shot and a good match. Whereas when you're looking at crowd shots in public facial recognition systems, your probability of match, of like being sure that you've got the right person, isn't going to be 100% in the first place. You have different angles, different shadows, like you're just looking at it from, the picture might not be entirely clear, right? So these sort of systems aren't necessarily built with the idea that you need perfect recognition in the first place. It's just meant to like try to find people in a crowd, and it gives you 10 people. It might be that's a close enough situation. But like I could see that even before we get to the point where it's better than that, in the situations where like when you go to get your passport taken, you need to like put your hair out of the way and you can't like be wearing glasses and things like that, right? So that's the sort of situation where I can imagine.
Yeah, and it's worth pulling apart. There are kind of different levels of fidelity required when it comes to different systems, right? Like some facial recognition systems are set up in malls to tell stores what percentage of people coming in their store are men or are 18 to 30 or are, you know, white, whereas other systems are being literally used for identification, right? Like in China, the WeChat ecosystem added, or they're testing facial recognition as a form of identification. So in certain provinces in China, if you have a WeChat system and you have facial recognition enabled, you can go into a police station or a hospital and scan your face with WeChat to prove that you are who you say you are. And that's considered reliable. Like they have a high degree of confidence. They've used this system and you scan it that you are who you say you are. Of course, this is kind of being turned on the population in a way. There's a problem in kind of bigger Chinese cities with jaywalking. People jaywalk a lot. It's a problem. It's dangerous. And part of the solution that has been deployed over recent years was to put up a giant TV, a giant kind of billboard screen, and show the faces of people who are jaywalking as kind of a public shame thing. Like, please don't be this jerk. Don't jaywalk. But at some point they realized, well, we have their WeChat, which is connected to their WePay bank account, and we have their facial scans from when they signed up for WeChat facial ID, why don't we just find them directly? Because we're confident that we know who they are. It's used for ID. So if you jaywalk in certain intersections, it will just automatically debit your account for the fine for jaywalking. It's very efficient.
I have so many
a question from Death,
from
I
death,
believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of along those same lines.
One sec, just the microphone is coming, just so it'll be on the recording.
Yeah, kind of along those same lines. I read an article, and I can't remember where I read it, basically about the Ring doorbell, that basically a lot of the people that purchased that opted in without their knowledge to share their cameras with law enforcement. And after I read that, I noticed that my local police were giving away Ring doorbells. And so those kinds of things, like, a lot of people don't understand the rights that they're giving away when they purchase those types of things. Or they think, like, great, well, that's awesome. The police are watching my doorstep. They don't realize, like, well, they're also, you know, taking, you know, video of every single person that walks down the sidewalk, you know, just minding their own business. So, you know, what steps do you guys think we can all take to help, you know, kind of raise awareness on that?
So that's a great question, and the Ring stuff has been deeply disturbing. I mean, it's not necessarily FR, but it's related, right? Because you're getting the footage. And you're absolutely right. You know, I think Motherboard has done some good reporting on this, and Gizmodo has also done some really good reporting on it. And yeah, we're definitely seeing a lot of these partnerships come up, and you know, the way that they've even directed some reporter questions about Ring partnerships to Ring PR, which just shows you what sort of relationship this is. You know, I think we are seeing a movement. San Francisco has passed a government use of face surveillance ban. Oakland has taken strides. The city of Somerville, Massachusetts has taken strides. We're seeing introductions of sort of city-level bans of government surveillance across the country. You know, those will only do so much because you're within the city jurisdiction, but we're now seeing some of the momentum of that being leveraged into state-level moratoriums. And so, you know, go talk to people, tell your elected officials your concerns. You know, there is language out there, there is momentum out there, and if it really concerns you, as I think it should, you know, definitely just go talk to people, spread the word, speak up.
I live in Toronto, and part of what's happening in Toronto right now is there's a Google has a smart city initiative for part of Toronto's waterfront. Right, there's kind of a bid put up like, hey, does anyone want to work on this development on the waterfront? Google, through one of their subsidiaries, did it and said, we're going to build kind of a model of the city of the future. It'll be smart roads and smart trash cans and smart everything. And the proposal didn't really speak about who owns the data, what they do with the data, what consent looks like for it. You know, and there might be an argument to be made that, you know, if you buy a house in this smart area and there's going to be facial recognition to let you in your house or figure out who's using how much garbage, that maybe you're signing something to consent to it. But what if you're homeless, right? Like, what if you are walking your dog in the park? Is that consent? And only through kind of the grassroots activism that's kind of come up at the municipal level to talk about, hey, we really need to have these conversations with any corporations we're engaging with in large contracts. This needs to be on the table before we talk about it. Now people are talking about facial recognition and how we push back. So I do think that in addition to kind of the legislative angle, which is mega important, if your government, municipal or otherwise, is doing business with companies like Amazon or Google or Facebook or the companies that have a lot of investment in AI or in facial recognition, holding your government accountable in a town hall kind of way, saying, hey, what is our policy for dealing with companies that do facial recognition, is a great way to kind of raise that topic as well.
So the question I have is, it seems like the bias is in the data sets, But is there anything inherent to the technology, like the actual scanning technology, that would that is also contributing to the bias? And we can't solve the problem of the bias mathematically, but we can solve the representational bias, right? So we can reject data sets that don't match certain demographics. Is that possible?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's like, that's the goal, right? This is the goal of many of the people building these systems. But that's, when you take it out of context, you can maybe solve that problem. But once you put it into a larger system, you have to end up thinking about these larger questions, what I was trying to get at earlier. So like, let's give an example, right? Like, you know, okay, I'm gonna use the obvious one here, which is the mugshots database, right? Like, the way the mugshots database works is you take the existing mugshots and you feed it in and you figure out, is this the person here? But when this is plugged into the system you have to think about at this point is the entire justice system of, you know, the state, right? The state is not the United States state. The state is an actor, political concept. And then you start having to think about, okay, well, is the system just? Is the system on its own without the, regardless of the input of the facial recognition system, is it treating people in a bias-free way? No. And so then you're thinking about, when you include a facial recognition in the first place, what you're doing is you're moving the human to a different place in the loop. So let me explain that a bit more. So previously, the way it worked before facial recognition is the human in the loop was sitting there and going, yes, I think it's this person. No, I don't think it's that person. Right? Now with the system, what you're doing is you're moving the human to the person who's creating the facial recognition system and the classification in the first place. So what you're doing here is you're saying this facial recognition system, like all AI technologies, is going to encode whatever bias of the person who created it. And as we opened with, that's 10% women and 2.5% black people. And so that's saying that a system without bias would do the same exact thing as a human would in that situation, which is to say that it encodes and perpetuates the existing bias of the system as it currently exists. So when you're thinking about creating any single system, you have to be thinking about, do I want to be encoding this bias into the system forever in the exact way that I have it now? So there's always going to be bias inherent in the system because it's encoding the biases of the person who created it, in that they had an idea of the world at the time it was created.
And makes it much more efficient for them to sort of perpetuate that bias throughout the rest of the system.
Yeah. Yeah. And to add on to that a little bit, so one of the things that that AI kind of bias problem we're having is with voice recognition software and kind of voice command software, which is often used by people with, who might have profound blindness or something like that. And so, because so many of those data sets, you know, like Hey Siri, are trained on voices of white men from California, that's a very particular kind of accent, it doesn't work for other people. And so, like at Mozilla, where I work, we have a project called Common Voice, where people can record themselves saying like the same phrases, and we collect recordings from people with different accents, different backgrounds, to make kind of an open data set that people can use to make accessibility technologies and that kind of thing. And sometimes that's good. At the same time, sometimes you get situations where, I believe it was researchers at IBM recently were like, oh, there's a problem with bias in facial recognition because the data set is not diverse enough. So they went to Flickr and scraped Flickr for photos of people's faces, and we're like, hey, we made a new training model based on people's faces, and everyone on Flickr whose faces were used in this were like, what the living hell? I didn't sign up to help cops, right? So I think that part of the problem is even if you're solving the problem, are you solving the problem or are you contributing to just kind of the institutional problems which already exist?
Good morning.
Good morning.
So while we're talking about this, I think we know that this technology is already indiscriminately used in China. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit more about implementation and feasibility in the United States. Just because I remember going over some articles recently where Amazon went in, I think, Miami and had 4 or 5 cameras set up in Miami that specifically failed because the city could not properly implement technology, like the video feeds necessary, like with the necessary amount of bandwidth to even transmit the amount of data they need to perform accurate recognition. Like, it was a complete and total failure funded by Amazon. Like, they promised to pay for everything. So, like, what, beyond these concerns, like, what are, is it even feasible for this to be properly implemented, given that most of the governments here are constrained budget-wise? They can't afford the technologies associated. Like, they tried to use traffic cameras at first. Clearly, those don't have high enough resolution. So, like, is there even a road to implementation for most localities in the United States?
So to me, that's part of what I find so disturbing about the Ring partnerships. I hate to harp on that, but, you know, we're definitely seeing companies come in and say, okay, look, we're just going to make it as easy for you as possible. We'll implement it. We'll distribute it. We'll pass them out. We'll get all this stuff together, and then we'll just give you the data. Like, just ask us for the data. We'll just give you the data. And so, you know, I also think, I mean, certainly government incompetence is a thing, but I don't want to rely on that as my safety net.
Yeah, I think that when you look at what's happening in China and how well implemented a lot of their kind of citizen surveillance and AI is, it's tough to imagine kind of North American or Western governments operating at the same efficiency. But we have corporations that have power and reach here in a scale that don't exist over there, right? Like, I don't think we need to worry on the same level about federal level governments doing that kind of thing. I think we need to worry about insurance companies teaming up with Amazon and saying, if you have too many undesirables coming to your house, maybe your home insurance is going to go up, right? So I think that the tools are here for it to be implemented. We just need to worry about it from the corporate end rather than the government end. And then the government can just kind of tap into that data.
So it can end up being privatized.
Exactly.
So we know that facial recognition is pretty much a cluster for people who have darker skin tones. Have there been any studies done as far as the accuracy for people who are transgender?
I don't know that. I don't know that particular question off the top of my head, but I think that question also gets at the question of affect recognition, which is a related field to facial recognition. And so affect recognition is in when you look at a face and you try to guess characteristics about that person. Like, given a picture of a face, what is this person's gender? What is this person's age? What is this person's race? And then the real... what is this person feeling? What does this person think? So, like, if I were to turn the camera out on all of you, like, so teachers, this is being sold to teachers as, like, let's use facial recognition on your students and see how engaged they are. Yeah, exactly. So, first of all, this is completely absurd as a premise. This is not a thing that is entirely possible. It encodes several assumptions, like, you can, like, that people express their emotions the same way that it is possible to tell people's emotions across cultures, across faces, across literally just individuals. Like, it is based on old, outdated psychological research, which has since been disproved, but nobody is telling that to the marketing teams at, well, the marketing teams are pretending they don't know this anyway at these companies. Right, so, and I think the question of gender is one of these in the first place, right? It's assuming that you can look at somebody's person, at somebody's face and know what gender they are. Like, maybe for many people you can make a guess because they're trying in particular to be read as a certain gender. But, like, that's not a given that you could do for the general population.
And this is anecdote, not data. But one of the people on the AI Tumblr panel tonight, Max Lander, is a photographer, artist, futurist, and also a trans dude. And he did a project where he was trying to figure out how well facial recognition would work on kind of, you know, would it be able to pick up on his childhood photos? Would it be able to determine if, you know, he's still him? And he ended up kind of using Photoshop and other tools to kind of continually distort his face to figure out, like, how far do I need to change my face before it recognizes him? And it's pretty damn far. Like, it successfully recognized all the childhood photos, any kind of early anything photos. So I think that it may or may not be good at gender, because gender is kind of a construct, but it is still good at figuring out if you are you, regardless of what your gender presentation is.
If that's the thing it's trying to solve.
If that's the thing it's trying to solve for.
Who had a question?
If it comes back to you.
Sort of piggybacking on an earlier question,
So with the proliferation of these Ring doorbells, do you think that it might be going down the road where, say, your homeowner's insurance won't cover you unless you have something like that?
I mean...
Yes.
I hate to crystal ball it, but yeah, I could definitely see that being a thing that happens.
Like the things that are in cars, like... So currently insurance companies have this thing, you put it inside your car, and if you drive well, it'll give you discounts, right? Like, we all see the clear next step being the same thing there. Although, as far as I know, they haven't done it yet. They haven't made it required for everyone yet. Hopefully that big barrier there is still a hurdle, because they've had this in cars for a while and haven't moved to that final stage. So hopefully we still have a bit of time.
I was going to say about the insurance thing. I remember reading an article, don't remember where, but I mean, insurance companies are starting to not just look at like who comes to your house, but just like social media. I've known that sometimes your credit score can be affected by whom you are friends with on Facebook if they are people who are deemed, you know, financially solvent or insolvent by these institutions. And to me, that's kind of incredible that like who you might be friends with, even if it's like a, oh, I just met you at this convention, let's be friends on Facebook, could potentially affect like things that like when later you're like, oh, I want to buy a house, and all of a sudden you can't because you have too many friends that might not be in the right, you know.
And you may never know that that is the reason either.
Yeah, that's creepy.
So this is something that is happening today in China with the social credit system, right? Yeah. Which is like your credit score, but for, I'm paraphrasing, but how good of a citizen are you, right? Like, how much are you contributing to the social fabric? And part of what it measures is what are the social credit scores of your friends, right? How many unpaid debts do your friends have? And the things that impact your social credit score are, some of them are kind of, you know, unknown signals, but some of them are very known. One of them, a recently added one was, so Counter-Strike Go got released in China relatively recently. And in order to play it, it's free to play and play it, you connect with your WeChat account. So it's connected to everything, right? Like WeChat is like Facebook plus Google plus everything, plus all government services. You can book a, you know, a doctor's visit, renew your driver's license. Like it's the internet, right? It's an extraordinary piece of work. One of the things they announced very proudly when they launched Counter-Strike Go in China is that if you cheat at Counter-Strike Go and you get caught, it'll impact your social credit score. And your social credit score can determine whether you get a visa to go somewhere, whether you can fly, what school your kids can go to, whether you can go onto certain dating apps. So that kind of combination of like these different signals about like what your friends do, what you do in your off time, things that have nothing to do with your health or with you at all, impacting, you know, the jobs that you might get or the, you know, the loans you might get or anything, is already happening, just not here. But it isn't a kind of like dystopian future. It's more of a dystopian present, just not fully distributed yet.
One of the things that you kind of mentioned, I think is interesting, is facial recognition seems to be like a piece in a bigger ecosystem. So I go to the grocery store, I do the self-checkout, it's taking my picture, now it knows what I buy. I get in my car, it's tracking that, my Ring doorbell. And in a society where things are monetized like that, how soon do you think before like insurance companies say, well, you know, we're not going to insure your health insurance because you buy chips 3 days a week or you drive on this dangerous road? I mean, that really seems like what is one of the things that's driving this facial recognition.
Yeah, I mean, so again, it's hard to say, you know, how soon. Like, I wish I could give you a date. Well, actually, I wish I could not give you not a date.
Well, I think that's the thing. I think we need to work to make that date not happen. Like, that answer is, it's not just going to happen in the inevitable sense of the word.
Right.
It is something that we can fight against and we are fighting against. And it's something that we could stop from happening with the appropriate controls over this sort of technology, right? So, like, if you just let the systems build themselves indiscriminately, that's something that might happen sooner rather than later. But You know, if we have controls in place to stop the sharing of information, to be have people have control over the information that's being used about them, like these are the sort of okay, Estonia has this government ID system, which is like, your driver's license is hooked up to a like PGP key or whatever, you know, it's like a real cryptography system that integrates all your data services, your doctors, everything like that. It was in the pre-AI era, but it's still the same sort of connection of all the different, if you want to access your bank account, you need the same thing that lets you make a doctor's appointment, that lets you like connect to the internet, right? So everything is very connected. But when it was put into, like, this is, I'm not advocating for the system, let's be clear. This is not the sort of thing that I'd be advocating for. But given that it does all these things, there are very good protections around it. So, like, the Estonian people have a portal that they can log into and see who is accessing their data. They can contact those companies and have control over the individual uses of those data. Like, the system was not built without any checks in place. I think there should be way more checks than that, and that users should have a lot more control over how people's data is being used. But it is not to say that this is the sort of system that only comes into place without any sort of control being built into it, and that if we fight for those controls, we can have them.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, We had a panel yesterday on the California Consumer Privacy Act, which I won't rehash, but you know, that's why the transparency pieces of those kinds of laws are so important. Just knowing what people have on you is so important. And to me, what's particularly scary about face recognition is, you know, just how immutable your face is, right? So maybe I could say, correct this thing about my credit record, or maybe I could say, you know, that is no longer true, but my face is always going to be my face.
Part of the problem with AI systems like this is, and we don't really talk about them on panels like this a lot, is that often they're quite useful, right? Like if Facebook and Google know everything about what I buy and when I shop, I'm going to get ads that are actually useful and relevant for my life, right? Like, people want that. People, I mean, in a world where it's good and accurate, right? It will make my life better and easier. If
you assume that what you want is to be like more of a consumer and have better items,
yes, of course,
right? Like,
thank
that's like
that is exactly what I'm assuming in this type.
But there are underlying assumptions.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah. But I think that, like, well, like, for example, in again, kind of to look at WeChat. So in one of the things that WeChat integration has made possible is there are kind of WeChat gas stations in kind of bigger cities in China where your license plate is already hooked up into the system. So you drive in, you pull up, it knows what kind of car you have, it knows what kind of gas you need. Someone comes out, they pump your gas, you drive away. It debits your account automatically, you never leave your car, and that's convenient, right? Like, a lot of people in North America would love that. They'd love to talk to fewer people and not get out of their cars and not have to worry about it. And I think that's part of what makes these systems really dangerous, is that the small amount of benefit that people get from it is very visible and obvious. If it's winter and I don't have to get out of my car, I notice that. And the huge amounts of kind of freedom and liberty you lose on the back end are largely invisible until you're in a position where you're disempowered. And I think it's really, really easy to not see that happening until it's too late on the individual level.
Question: I was wondering if you had any comments on the data that China was using with the whole—I can't say the word right—Huawei or Huawei.
Uyghur.
Thank you. And then the other comment I just had for you guys who were asking the medical stuff is: so in the United States, HIPAA law protects that only for medical issues in medical groups. So if you're on Facebook and you share all your medical stuff and you're in a Facebook support group, none of what you share there is protected by HIPAA. So anytime you're yapping about your the medicines you're taking, or how your fibro is bothering you, or how you're struggling with cancer, or what genetic test you took, those companies have it, and they're building it into these data sets, and they're building it into your facial recognition. What your doctor has, you can't release, but what you guys put out there, you can. So please knock off the medical data sharing. Just nip it. Don't do it. Do it in a bar quietly drinking, okay? but I'm just curious about that whole Huawei thing about what's in the cell phones and how that made it into the United States and what you guys think they may be doing with that.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Yes, sorry, I can't say it right.
Oh, different Huawei question. Oh, different Chinese thing going on.
The other Chinese thing.
Yeah. Right. I will say that in Canada, it is not, you're not allowed using their equipment in any Canadian federal communication system.
Yeah.
And that's been that way for a number of years. So I think that at least from the Canadian kind of intelligence perspective, it isn't like we know they're not trusted, and the exact details of what's happening in there can change day to day, but they're not a trusted system.
Yeah. I don't know that much about that.
I think they just extended a 90-day extension to their ban. Like, they stopped the ban, and the Department of Commerce just gave them another 90 days to continue investigating and whether or not. So they're, like, kind of half banned, but then they kind of keep delaying the ban because, you know, money and stuff. So I don't know.
137 proposals that have Huawei technology integrated in the U.S.
Right. I mean, I think in Canada, at least, the consensus is even if theoretically there's no holes in it and they're not doing anything wrong today, the government could compel them tomorrow to put something in secretly. So even if it is in theory secure today, it is not something that we can guarantee will be secure when we need it to be.
They found it in Italy. Like, Italy uses Huawei for their centralized telecommunications infrastructure, and then they found a backdoor in that infrastructure. Mm. So, like, it's happened.
Right.
I didn't know. I don't follow. This is not my area of expertise, but I am shocked to learn this because it's, how is that different from every other phone that's manufactured in China?
Authoritarian government? No, it's not.
Yeah.
It's scarier.
It's not.
Okay. Huawei
has pretty close links to the Chinese government and the Chinese army.
Like, more directly.
Yeah.
There's definitely been some established communication and very close.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, you know, you're looking at kind of like the NSA working with AT&T also to, you know, monitor American traffic. So I think in some of it really is kind of like the Red Scare, but that's kind of the current state of things.
Hey, guys. So I'm trying to figure out how to couch this. So you kind of alluded to some of the things you were excited about, well, not excited about, but maybe some of the benefits of FR technology, right? Mm-hmm. What, you know, maybe ask one of you, you know, each one of you to give an example of things that you're excited about, right? Because I think a lot of times in these panels, we get down the rabbit hole of, like, you know, I'm going to live in a Walden-style house, and, you know, throw everything away. I mean, so obviously protections, you know, transparent laws are part of that. But is there anything, I mean, I have an Amazon account. I would like, you know, if I'm going to be served ads anyway, I'd like them to be targeted. You know what I mean? What are the benefits of this technology, and how do you balance that with, you know, what needs to happen for it to be?
I mean, I have a good example for that, which I think I actually suspect this is a temporary example and that it will soon go away. But I'm pretty excited about it for authentication. So to be able to look at your phone and unlock your phone, even if it's not completely perfect, it's still... It's like seatbelts, right? The biggest problem, the biggest failure method of a seatbelt is that people don't turn it on. The biggest failure of people to lock their phones is that they don't have a number code lock on them. So facial recognition technology, and before that, fingerprints, significantly, greatly increased, like made it so the majority of people have their phones locked most of the time, and that wasn't the case before this. Now, I mentioned that I think this is a temporary state because I suspect that you can't change your face, right? It can only work as authentication until every single person's face is leaked, and then this is completely useless. But we are now in that brief window of time where it has convinced people to increase their security on their phones by adding a facial lock to it, which is better than having no security at all.
I'm thinking. The problem with my job is I'm oriented towards what is on fire, so let me think about it.
I think that there are potential applications for things like community safety. Like, I think that it is possible that we will get to a point where you can have a camera at something like a party at Dragon Con, and if someone appears to be in distress, whether that's because they're being harassed or they're about to have a seizure, that, like, an alarm can go off and, like, safety personnel can go figure out what's happening and help them. I think this is a theoretical benefit. I think community groups could probably, at some point, if there's kind of an open database of undercover police officers, you might be able to kind of like share that information with other community groups and kind of like have community groups protect themselves from infiltration. I think that's a potential option. But I don't think we're there yet. Did you have one, Haley?
Oh, no, I mean, I think in general, like, I don't ever think technologies are evil, right? It's the way that they're implemented, it's the way that they're abused. So, I mean, I'm certainly not saying stop all research on this forever. Just think about, you know, how we're using it. So, yeah.
It's totally right.
Sorry, I'm going to make this depressing again. I was hoping, since you brought it up, I was hoping if you, I've only heard about it, but if you guys could discuss how China is using facial recognition to discriminate against Uyghur Muslims and how they're using that to, like, jail them, put them into confinement. I don't know if you guys know anything about that. I don't know.
I know the high level of details, right? Like, I don't know the, I haven't personally investigated the app. There's an app that the police, okay. Yeah, so there's definitely an app that, I don't remember if it's just the police have it or they also have community people downloading it. Anyway, there's some class of person who is designated the person who checks things, right? And so they download this app onto their phone and it has facial recognition technology and they're required to go around to different people's houses and show up and be like, oh, is this the person over here who I've known this? And like answer all these questions about them and like, oh, has this person been doing X? Check. Has this person been doing Y? Check. So it's using more, machine classification than just the facial recognition on top of that. And based on the answers to these questions, will determine what sort of result happens to the person. And also it's being used on the streets and surveillance to look who is, to track people's locations, to always know people's locations. And if, for example, like, I mean, it's largely a religion thing, right? So if you're going to the wrong religious observance on the wrong day, you are going to be marked for further investigation. And yeah, right, exactly, things like that.
So I'm
did
curious.
You have, did,
oh, I was
sir,
just
did you know?
That like so with Uyghurs, not only is there like sort of facial recognition just like in public spaces, but often where Uyghurs go, there's like barriers to entry, almost like going onto an airport, like even just going to like a shopping mall, you stop, you get looked at, you get searched. So there's many, many, many layers. It's not just this hidden thing, it's very public as well. And from what I know about the Uyghurs, like, they like realize that, like, you gotta be in smaller groups, because if you're in a bigger group, you're more of a interesting thing, so spread out. But it's also hard, because, like, if girls are too spread out, people might not know, where did someone go last night? So, yeah.
So I'm curious to know the panel's personal resistance to these type of things in terms of, like, do you have a social media account? Do you opt out of the body scans? You know, do you go ahead and not use Google Maps? Where are you guys at personally with trying to avoid things like this?
Personally, I make bad decisions. So what I do is I opt in to everything. So I have my Google location history on. It's been on since day one. I've got my sharing on Facebook, highest share possible. Because what I do kind of a lot of like safety training and that kind of thing. And I work on kind of like internet health issues. And I need to know what the experience is for people who aren't tech savvy in order to know what the benefits they're getting are and what the dangers they're getting are. So, like, I can look on my Google account and I can see exactly where I was on any date, like 8 years ago, which is really useful when, you know, maybe talking to people who were victims of domestic violence and trying to figure out how does their partner know where they are at any given point in time. And I can be like, well, here's my phone and you can look it up and here's how it all works. So I make bad decisions and I am as exposed as it's possible for someone to be exposed because that's kind of how I do my work, but I don't recommend it.
That's funny, I was about to give a very similar answer for different things. Like location tracking isn't the one that I do, but I do a lot of messaging work, so I use four different messaging apps with every single person because I always want to know exactly what the experience is for different people. Like, it's my job to be making this better for everyone, and I don't think that I should be, like, doing the things that I know I can do to avoid it, because what I want is that nobody has to be doing those things in the first place. So, yeah.
I enjoy that we all have similar approaches because so prior to this, I was a consumer tech reporter. So it was my job also to test things and try and figure out the privacy holes. And I still do it for privacy legislation so that I can say, look at this thing that is in this app. But, you know, locking, that's not helpful in a practical sense. So, I mean, certainly locking down your settings. You know, my husband uses a different account for his Google Maps. Like, it's just a Google Maps account that he signs into. Anyway, I don't know.
One of my coworkers his face, you can't find it. His wife has an Instagram account, and they're always posting pictures of, like, the dog and the two of them hanging out, and his face will be cropped out of it, right? So he is particularly interested in not having his face show up in many different versions.
That's true. And the face one is hard. I mean, especially if we're talking about surveillance, like, you just...
Can't. But, like, it's noticeable. It's hard. It takes a lot of effort. Like, she's always commenting, oh, I had to, like, reframe this picture because he didn't want to be in this one again. It's not easy to do this sort of thing. It's unfortunate that people have to.
Or, you know, I don't post pictures of I have a 10-month-old nephew. I post no pictures of him anywhere, which is too bad because he's super adorable and you would all benefit from seeing him.
if you're looking at kind of more recommendations, like what I might suggest you do, there's an organization called Tactical Tech, and they have like a free download called Data Detox, which is kind of like a 10 days, walk yourself through, like, looking at the settings for kind of the most common apps. And they do a lot of really, really good kind of like resetting your basics training. That's all free as far as your social media footprint. So as far as a recommendation of what someone else should do is I would look at kind of the Tactical Tech training. I think they do really, really good work.
I was just going to say, I work in tech too, but not luckily anything where I have to do any of that. But one thing that I've found that works good, you know, with the passports and stuff, it's super easy to go through with the, you know, where they offer the facial and stuff like that. But if you take a minute before you get to that point, you know, whether it's body scanning or the facial recognition, just kind of think, like, what do I want to put up with? Like, what do I want to do? It makes it a lot easier once you get there, you know, and you don't have to be a jerk to just say, no, I'm going to opt out. And then they're okay with it. I mean, you know, and yeah, it's going to take a few extra minutes, so you can plan for that. But you can. And while we still can, you know, do it if it makes you uncomfortable. But I think, you know, kind of thinking it through before you get in that, like, rush with the line and actually everything else, kind of like, you know, reading up a little bit and actually figuring out what your options actually are makes it a whole lot easier when you actually get in the situation, or at least it did for me.
I mean, that's practical, but I hate that you have to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, we're at time now?
We're at time.
We are at time. Very good. Sorry for anyone whose question we didn't get to, but come bug us. Please rate this panel in the DragonCon app. And that way we will get more cupcakes in the future. Also, they'll bring us back. But thank you. All the questions were amazing. Thank you for putting up with us and being here so early.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.